So thank you very much for coming to this, and I want to thank the devotees for inviting me to come and speak. This is something of an experiment for me to speak in front of so many different devotees who speak so many different languages, coming from so many different cultures. I myself am fairly well embedded in the United States of America, and we are in an international movement, so this is a very good chance for me to find out what's going on outside of the United States, maybe for you to find out what's going on inside the United States, which is a big mystery to everybody. So the topic we wish to discuss today, this is in two parts, so we'll have a chance to go back and cover some more of this ground again, should we fail to understand everything today, is the topic of other religions. I've titled this Religion and Religions, in quotation marks. And basically we want to discuss for ourselves what is our view of other religions and how do we relate to them and how do we relate to the efforts of people from various religions to try to understand each other. How do we relate to the academic study of religions where professors are very much engaged in comparative study of religion, history of religions, interreligious dialogue, and all these other things. So I've participated in some of this stuff myself and come to some conclusions. You should know that, first of all, I came to this movement before I was a devotee. I was, in fact, a student of religions in the university. One fairly new phenomena has been something that's called the academic study of religions, where study of religion has emerged as an academic specialty. This comes from a work originally started in Germany, as a matter of fact, by scholars, History of Religions, that religions themselves could be looked to in a historical context, and we could study them much as we study anything else in terms of their growth, their development, and so on. This has gradually led to this idea of the academic study of religions, the scientific study of religions, sometimes called. So you have all different kinds of religions, and then you have people who are studying religions from a historical or scientific point of view, independently of any personal participation. They may or may not themselves be believers, but they're supposed to be studying it scientifically. So this is the area into which we find ourselves placed. This is our situation. So first of all, when we look at religions and religion, the first thing we have to know is that the idea of religion that most people have in the modern West is something fairly recent. In the West, our idea of religion is a product of an historical process which goes by the name in English of secularization. I'll write that word on the board. comes from the Latin word secular, meaning the world. So in modern times, the modern West is the historical product of this process called secularization. Max Weber talks about the disenchantment of the world. This began really with the Enlightenment of the 18th century. And the notion is that the world becomes the area for the function of human reason and science. And human society itself becomes subject to rational control. So this is, in this idea of secularization, it does not mean that there is no religion, but that religion has its own special place. That the area in which we operate for the exercise of political power, for making money, for the pursuit of knowledge, this area is secular. And within that secular area, everybody follows the same rules and regulations, operates on the same presumptions. And then on Sunday, you can go to church and worship as you like. You do not take your religious convictions and move them into this secular area. This is the modern accommodation and the ideas. When people say, "What is your religion?" They want to know, what do you do on Sunday, or maybe you have a few rituals in your home. But otherwise, you're just like everybody else. And what most people mean by religion is a religion that has accommodated itself to this way of operating. And this is what people mostly all over the world are. And this is why Krishna consciousness strikes them as very strange, because we are not part of this process of secularization. There is no difference between our religion and our life. But in the modern world, the secularization, there's been this split. So the idea of religion that people have is the idea of something that is an extra, something added on to human life. So this is the notion that people have of religion. There's human life, and the people go on about it. They make money, they do so many things, and then they have this thing called their religion off to the side. Well, there's been studies of this, especially in English. A professor named Wilfred Cantwell Smith has written a book called The Meaning and End of Religion. He was at Harvard and University of Toronto, which was a study of the idea of religion. And he saw how it was a product of this secularization process. So this has been noted. And he noted that in pre-modern times, people's religion was not separated from their lives. There wasn't this clear-cut division. But when people come to us and they say, "What is your religion?" They really have this expectation that we're normal people that on the side, we do something funny or different. As you see, one of the things we'll touch upon a little later on is the rise of what is called fundamentalism. Hindu fundamentalism, Christian fundamentalism, Islamic fundamentalism. I'm not sure what all these have in common to call them fundamentalism, but one thing is they are all reactions against this secularization. And each of them wants to form a government which is governed by Islamic, Hindu, or Christian religious principles. And that's why they're regarded as a huge threat. You can be as fundamentalistic as you like, but please don't bring it into the government. You have the situation where you can have people who are, say, scientists who worship God, who believe in God, who maybe are very, very fundamentalistic in some ways, but when they go into their laboratory, all that's forgotten. And they'll say things like, you hear them all the time, oh yes, I believe in God, but as a scientist, you see, I cannot take that into account. So he does, he believes in God, but somehow when it comes to dealing with knowledge, that has to be set aside, as though it had nothing to do with the pursuit of knowledge. This is this split that we have. Now, we don't belong in the secular, these categories of religion. And to illustrate this, I want to tell a story. Now, this happened in the early 70s in New York. Srila Prabhupada came to the airport in New York, and we used to all go up and greet him. I came from Philadelphia, maybe an hour and a half trip, so there would always be a big crowd of devotees to greet Srila Prabhupada. And we used to have press conferences for him at the airport, right there in the lounge. So there was a huge number of devotees there. Srila Prabhupada came. He had a press conference. It was an interesting press conference, by the way. The reporter said to him, why have you come to the West? And Prabhupada said, I have come to give you a brain. And then he explained how the social body has a head, arms, belly, and legs, just like the human body, and that currently society was headless. Actually, he said, it is mostly leg with some belly. So anyway, there was this very interesting press conference, and then Prabhupada went to go to the temple. So we're going down this long hallway, and I was a few steps behind Srila Prabhupada. And then we could see coming the other way was this reporter running like crazy. He was late for the press conference. He was a television reporter. He had a microphone and some cables going back to a man with a big camera. This was before the days they had little tiny television cameras. This was a huge thing, and this guy was running like this. They were coming running up. And he stopped immediately in front of Prabhupada. It was like this. Prabhupada had to step back a bit. So I happened to be standing right next to Prabhupada when this happened. I saw it very close. And this microphone came, you know, and he stuck it right in Prabhupada's face and said, he was like huffing. He says, how does your religion differ from other Buddhists? So everybody was immediately a little confused because, of course, we're not Buddhists. But everybody immediately felt also, how can we say we're, you know, how to tell them? It's wrong to say we're exactly Hindus either. We didn't think of ourselves really as Hindus. But Prabhupada looked at him straight in the face, and he said this. He said, we have nothing to do with this Hinduism or Buddhism. He said, we are speaking the truth, and if you are truthful, you will accept it. That's what he said in the report. It just didn't. He was so confused at that point. No, no, no. He wanted to know. See, he had boxes in his head, Hinduism, Buddhism, and all he wanted to do was, you know, put Prabhupada in the right box and then forget about it. You know. So, let's look at Prabhupada's answer for a minute. It seems to most people to be elusive. And maybe what we would want to say, well, actually we're not Buddhists, we're Hindus, and actually in Hinduism we're part of the Gaudiya Vaishnava sect, right? That's not what Prabhupada did. He said, we have nothing to do with this Hinduism or Buddhism. We are speaking the truth, and if you are truthful, you will accept it. What he did was try to destroy the mental platform on which the question was asked. If you answer the question, no, we're Hindus, you reinforce the mental platform. And there ends the prospect of any further spiritual knowledge being transmitted. The man has filled in his answer in his little box and his questionnaire and is going on to the next thing. So when Prabhupada did this, he wanted to preach Krishna consciousness. And all of us who have accepted Krishna consciousness have not accepted it because we wanted to become Hindus or even Vaishnavas. We simply accepted it because we became convinced it was the truth. The reporter's question presupposed already that a secularized understanding that here you are going on in this world and off to the side you have your religion, Hinduism, Buddhism, something like that. And Prabhupada just destroyed the platform. And so when he says the truth, oh, all of a sudden it becomes not a matter of religion at all, but of something else, something much more important, something about what is the truth. Because this is another product of secularization. That the area of the truth is one thing, and the area of religion is the area of, well, belief, let's say. And we have different kinds of books. We have certain kinds of books which give us knowledge. And over here we have another kind of books called scripture. And for that reason, we fall actually into a trap when we take Prabhupada's books and call them scripture. Immediately, when people hear that, they think, oh, these are books in which you believe. They don't really tell us about the truth. The truth is found out in scientific journals. But here is a matter of belief. Well, Prabhupada did not come to present a religion. He said, I've come to give you a brain. He described Krishna consciousness as a cultural movement for the re-spiritualization of the entire human society. That's right in the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam. And we should take those words very seriously. A cultural movement for the re-spiritualization of the entire human society. And when he said to the reporters, I've come to give you a brain, he meant brahmanas. What are brahmanas? People who know the truth. They know what the truth is. The same truth. Truth is truth. It's the same for everybody. But they can see it. Yeah. Jnanam. They know the truth. Vijnanam. And they know how to apply it to practical human affairs. Mostly, they tell, they guide the kshatriyas, the politicians. So this is the what Prabhupada was presenting. So over and over again, Prabhupada, you'll find in his books, is very careful to say what he means by religion. He says, by religion I do not mean a particular faith. When people say religion, they mean a particular faith, Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity. You'll see this everywhere, many, many places. Prabhupada discusses this. He said, but that is not religion. He wants to use religion to translate dharma. This is the Sanskrit word that Prabhupada calls religion. It comes from a verbal root. Dri, the Sanskrit verbal root, which means basically to uphold or to sustain. And by certain rules, it's derived from this. Aspiration in there. H. Dri. To uphold or to sustain. So that this word dharma means really that by which a thing is what it is. Its essence, its intrinsic nature. The dharma of sugar is to be sweet. The dharma of fire is to be hot. It's religion. The religion of sugar is sweetness. The religion of fire is heat. These are Prabhupada's explanations of this word dharma. That which makes a thing what it is. Its essence. It's equivalent to this other word. Swarup also means essence. The way we use the word dharma, its essential nature. Swarupa means its own form, its own peculiar character. So Prabhupada said that therefore you cannot change your dharma. You can change from Hinduism to Christianity to Buddhist to Muslim, but you cannot change it. So if you can change it, it's not your dharma. And so what we are teaching, he says, is Bhagavad Dharma or Sanatan Dharma, the eternal religion of the spirit soul. So right away we're off this platform of religion or religions. Recently, we've been meeting in the United States with members of the group called the Vishwa Hindu Parishad. And they want to know, why don't we call ourselves Hindu? So we are in one particular group, and Sridhar Swami was there meeting with us, and he said, well, when I met my spiritual master, the first thing I learned from him is that I am not this body. And there was a whole group of these Hindus around. And they all understood that. Everybody believes this, aham brahmasmi. I don't get Mayavadis or Vaishnavas. Everybody who accepts the Vedas accepts this aham brahmasmi. So they say, yes, we understand. I'm not my body. So therefore, he says, I'm not, you know, male or female or Western or Eastern or any bodily designation. So he said, I learned this, it was a great truth, it set me free from the conditions of material nature. They're all going, yes. So he said, so therefore it becomes very difficult for me to turn around and say, I'm Hindu. And they were like, well, yeah, we understand. They said, we understand, but still you can use. So it was interesting. So I said to them, I see, because they were all nodding, yes. I said, so you have to be a Hindu to understand you're not a Hindu. But they can understand this because it's a bodily designation, and they all know that this word Hindu is anyway a foreign word, and it's not in the Vedas, and that the real term is Sanatan Dharma. We use the word, Prabhupada always used the word, by the way, which we use. Vedic. It's a Vedic culture. This gets us into trouble with academics sometimes. You should be aware of this. And if you want to use it, just tell them that you know what you're doing. For them, Vedic refers to the language of the first nine books of the Rig Veda and the culture associated with it. That's what they mean by Vedic. They have this historical view. And then after that, there was all this change and development, and later on Hinduism grew out. So many new things go on, and so on. And when we say Vedic, we're implicitly denying all that. We're saying, you know, there's one thing that goes through all these centuries. And that's what we are practicing, Vedic culture. And so that is an assumption none of them believe in, because they have this historical idea, history of religion's idea. So I just simply say, in an academic context, when I use the word Vedic, I explain, I mean, you know, the first, the original Vedas, plus the associated literatures, such as the Puranas and so on, Mahabharata, because a Veda also means, you know, the Rig Veda, Sama Veda, Atharva Veda, Yajur Veda, up to and including the Upanishads, what we call Shruti. And then the supplement is Smriti. And Madhvacharya says they're all Vedas. Mahabharata is called the Panchama Veda, the fifth Veda. So that we can take that as our definition, if we want. We don't have to go by the definition of somebody who learned Hinduism at the University of Chicago or whatever. We can have our own definition. But you have to explain to people why, how we're using this word, because they'll be shocked. They have something else in mind. Anyway, we have to be careful about this. Understand the perspective that's there when we speak about when we speak about Krishna consciousness, especially when we go and we're preaching Krishna consciousness. It's easy enough for us to be co-opted. I don't know what taken over by other categories. There's a difference sometimes between public relations and preaching. If we do public relations right, it'll be no difference. But if the goal of public relations, you could say, is to survive, but the goal of preaching is to prevail. Of course, if you don't survive, you can't prevail. But it's convenient for us sometimes to be seen as Hindus. It's convenient for sometimes, or expedient, for us to be seen as a minority religion. And certainly Prabhupada has done that also. His preaching to us is, this is not a religion, this is a cultural movement. And yet we didn't hesitate to declare ourselves as a religion to the government in order to get tax-exempt status. Nor when the government in England was giving us problems with our Rath Yatra, we immediately said, this is a Hindu ceremony, even though we know it has nothing to do with Hinduism. Um, But so one can do this, but we can't accept it as our own self-identification. And when we preach to people, these kinds of categories can be very difficult, because actually you have to do what Prabhupada did. You have to destroy their mental platform. To be open to actually receive Krishna consciousness, people have to rearrange their categories of thought. They have to see Bhagavad Gita not as the scripture of a Hindu religion. Did Krishna think that that's what he was telling Arjuna? Now I'm going to give you a Hindu scripture? No, I'm going to tell you the truth. This is the truth. When Jesus was preaching, did he think he was preaching Christianity? No. This is the truth. Everybody, Muhammad also, this is the truth. They didn't think they were starting religions. They just thought they were telling people the truth. So religion is a human concoction, in that sense. And people have realized that. For example, there's a famous Swiss theologian, Karl Barth, maybe familiar with him, conservative Christianity. He made this claim that Christianity is not a religion. But his reasoning was interesting. He said, religion is man's attempt to go to God, but Christianity is God's attempt to God's coming to man, so therefore it's different. His claim was the only place that there's any revelation is in Christianity. So that's not our position either, that we are the only ones holding any revelation. We don't want to be, we have to watch out for this word religion. Minority religion, scripture. When I gave a paper at this conference on science and religion, the very first thing I did was try to do what Prabhupada did, was blow the structure. It was about science and religion. And I wanted to get rid of that two categories. The science on this side, religion on that side. So I started talking about Vedaishta Sarva Ahameva Vedyaha. By all the Vedas, I am to be known. But then if you look at this, you see there's two words, Vedais and Veda. Vedyaha. Vedyaha means to know. Vedais means by all Vedas. You can take Vedas to mean these particular set of books. But really, it means any process of knowledge. If you just think of these books, you're going to think the Hindu scriptures. Is Krishna claiming by all the Hindu scriptures I am to be known? Well, that's not quite right, is it? Because the ancient Vedic culture didn't think of themselves. Those were books of knowledge, that's all. They weren't scriptures over off to the side. They were their books of knowledge. And that's our preaching claim, that these are books of knowledge for everybody. So Krishna's claim, Vedaishta Sarva Ahameva Vedyaha, means by all processes of knowledge I am to be known. And the word science comes from a Latin word, to know, sciere. Scire means the verb know, science. Science just means knowledge. So you could say that Krishna is saying, by all science I am to be known. All science is a seeking after me. So if you let people start by thinking, Vedaishta Sarva Ahameva Vedyo, that Krishna is the goal of all Vedic scriptures, well, that may be an interesting claim for students of religion to check out. And maybe it's true. Maybe one could show that all the Vedas really lead toward Krishna. But still, what difference does that make? Those are those scriptures over there. But if you say by all science you're looking for Krishna, then that's a much more interesting claim. And then I would try to go on to show that that's in fact the truth, that all science is searching after Krishna. And they're not these different camps, science versus religion, one religion versus another. So the first thing we do, we want to just blow all the structures away. They're categories of looking at things. So, meanwhile, of course, what's going on in the world today is in fact that you have this situation that, first of all, you have the rise of modern material science and the associated secular culture around it, which is dominating the globe. And then also at the same time, because of that, you have various religions coming into intimate contact with each other. This is now the global situation. It used to be you could stay in your parish, and people used to be able to say, there's a famous statement in England, by religion, I mean the Christian religion. And by the Christian religion, I mean the Church of England. That's what I mean by religion. You can't get away with that anymore. There are mosques all over France. England has got so many different things going on. Some English towns have more Hindus than they do anything else. Everything has become interpenetrated like this. So our situation is the situation of what they call in America the religious pluralism, or cultural pluralism sometimes, like that. And again, the safe thing is to try to keep all the religions off in the side and keep the secular sphere where everybody can cooperate together. So anyway, it's become a very small world. Everybody's rubbing against each other. You can't escape this religious diversity. And so people have turned their attention to this problem. And they're thinking that somehow or other many of our problems come from this diversity of religion. Because people tend to fight each other along those lines in many cases. Hindus and Muslims and Jews, Protestants and Roman Catholics. So people have thought that if somehow or other we can come to some kind of understanding, we will make the world a more peaceful place. So that's given rise to this idea of interreligious dialogue and to the notion that we ought to somehow or other become one human family and get along with each other despite these differences, that they don't have to ultimately end in slaughter. And so you have this dialogue, interreligious dialogue movement, interfaith movement. And I think also part of it is because some people, at any rate, can recognize that in other religious traditions, there are people who are genuinely, to some degree or another, spiritually advanced, or at least have something of the truth, and you don't want to write them out. And there's also, of course, this big fear of the rise of these fundamentalisms. This is a reaction to the secularization. It's maybe the revenge of the third world, I don't know, against modernity. But we have it in America. We have Christian fundamentalists. They have what they call Hindu fundamentalists. Vishwa Hindu Parishads, supposed to be in the forefront of that. Of course, Islamic fundamentalists, some of you may know what's going on in Algeria. They had their first free election, and the fundamentalist party won. And won with almost enough votes to overturn the constitution and cancel free elections after that. So the present government has now canceled those elections, and everybody's waiting to see what's going to happen next. So they're very worried about this kind of thing. France is worried because it has so many Muslims all over France now. They're afraid of what will happen. So this is the fundamentalists. And the fundamentalists, one of their signs seemed to be, we have the truth and nobody else does. Of course, sometimes they mean a kind of nationalism. It goes along with nationalism. Hindu fundamentalism seems to be mostly nationalistic and directed against the Muslims. You know, the big fight is over the Ram Janmabhoomi, the birthplace of Ramchandra, which is an interesting sort of a thing. So it's hoped somehow or other that people can sit down and talk to each other, and that the edge of this fundamentalism, which is confrontational and confrontation and hostility, can somehow or other be removed by interreligious dialogue and so on like this. So for people, it's a problem, this plurality of religions or religious diversity. And if you deal with academics or with people from other religions, we have to confront this. Now, I think that we can make the claim that that the Bhagavad Gita actually deals very much with the issue of religious pluralism. Even though it's considered, you know, it sticks within the Vedic context of people who are followers of the Vedas, still there's so much diversity going on within Vedic tradition, Hinduism or whatever you want to call it, that that in fact the Bhagavad Gita has to deal with this diversity. I heard one Islamic scholar claim that the Quran was the first scripture to deal with religious pluralism, because it deals in the area that Islam grew up. The Jews were there, the Christians were there, and the Quran does address them. And in fact, all three traditions, the Islamic traditions, Christian traditions, Jewish traditions, they all accept the first five books of Moses, the Old Testament essence, as scripture. They all do that. By the way, when I explain to people what about this word Hinduism, like when I go give college classes, I point out that if you took all the Christian traditions, all the Jewish traditions, and all the Islamic traditions, and called them Semitism, you would have about the same situation as Hinduism, because they all accept a common scripture. They all have a common cultural basis, but there's no one that believes in Semitism. The same thing, you know, with what you call Hinduism. They all accept the same scriptures. They all believe in Varnashram Dharma. Yet you won't find anybody who's like a Hindu in the sense that they believe in something, a Hinduism, unless it's political, of course. Anyway, the Quran, this Islamic scholar made this claim about the Quran. And then when I was thinking about it, I realized that the Bhagavad Gita actually deals with this problem of religious diversity. And we're in a very good position, actually, because this has been dealt with long time ago. and some amount of harmony has been brought to the situation. The Vedas are described as a desire tree. The Kalpa Toro, or Kalpa Taru, means you can get whatever fruit you want. Bananas, apples, oranges, kumquats, mangoes, you know, whatever you want. So here's the Vedas, and they give so many different fruits like that because people are different and on different platforms. So one way to look at the Bhagavad Gita as a study of different Vedic paths.